All right, so seems like last week at the end of class, we had just finished up our examination of the speeches of Elihu. There's four of them, cover six chapters in the book of Job, chapters 32 through 37. And it seems like there were a few leftover questions or comments that we just didn't have time to address. So if you have one of those leftover questions or comments, Mr. Shrigley would always say in class, lay on, Macduff. So what's your question or comment? Anybody remember? You know, that's what I always try to do is put you off a week and then you forget your questions. So anybody remember what your holdover comment was from last week? Well, that's quite all right. I'll ask you the questions then. All right, so based on everything we talked about, we kind of did this question. We were running out of time. Your overall assessment of Elihu, after we got done going through those chapters, and of course, you know, I kind of put my cards on the table and told you I have a generally negative view of him, but certainly open, because in a book as mysterious and profound as this, we should always be open to, you know, reinvestigating things, taking a different look. Anybody have any reflections that have come to you over the last week as you pondered the speeches of Elihu and where he fits into this book? Yeah, Dean?
I really, really liked his response. Well, you know, he showed a lot of patience in waiting for all his other three friends, even though he was young. And, you know, I look at it as Job answered, he listened to all those responses, and Job was getting so confident, almost on the edge of cockiness. And I think that that was the only response that he had to offer, was to be able to go toe-to-toe, because as we talk with someone one-on-one, a lot of times you have to kind of get on their level. So I actually thought he did a really good job within the realm that he knew, the worldview that he knew, to try to reason with this, even though he didn't know the big picture. So I kind of lean towards he was doing the best he can with the situation.
So I appreciate Dean's comment, and especially I appreciate this aspect of what Dean just said. You know, Dean just made the comment that Job was becoming so brash, you know, to the point of arrogance, it seems like, that you know, it was important for somebody to speak up to him and so try to deal with that, and that's what Elihu did. And I think certainly whatever view you take of Elihu and the friends, there's no question that one of the reasons they react the way that they do against Job, which is a very visceral reaction, is because Job is saying so many strident things about God that, you know, if any of us, I'm sure of it, if I had been there and I heard Job say the sorts of things that he was saying, I would have gotten ticked off and I would have felt like I've got to defend God and I've got to speak up for him. And you remember that that's exactly what Elihu says he's doing. He calls himself, I'm a spokesman for God. And I think that to that extent, we can be sympathetic with him. Yeah, Dwayne? Yeah. Three chapters, right? Yeah. So Dwayne's point is if they could have just let Job vent, you know, then the book would have been a lot shorter. Right, which I think that's exactly right. Yeah, Brad?
I know you alluded to this last week, I think it was. I found myself wondering why this speech is even in there. Because much of it wrong or incorrect.
Yeah.
Why is it included?
Very, very good question Brad asks, which is, in fact, just take the equation, or take whether Elihu's primarily right or wrong, just take that out of the equation. The fact that nobody seems to reference the speech is, nobody seems to ever reference Elihu again, makes you wonder, well, then what was the whole point of this? You know, either be for or again, but just to, the Passover wipe. So what I suggested for you, and I think probably most any commentator, whatever view they take of Elihu will say is, remember, what is the last topic that Elihu brings up as he's trying to explain, look, God is too powerful for any of us to ever think he should answer to us. What does he bring up to illustrate that? Say it again. The majesty of God displayed how? In storm and in creation, yeah. He picks out specific things like rain, storm, and in other words, from the created order. And when the Lord speaks, which is what we're going to start to study tonight, his first speech also focuses on the created order. So the reason I think the speeches are where they are, whatever we are to make of them, is at least we can say from a topical standpoint, they are a natural transition into the Lord's speech. Because the Lord is going to talk about some of the same things. Although, I suggested to you last week that a perceptive and inquiring Bible student would ask themselves the question, I wonder what's different about what God says about the created order as opposed to Elihu. I mean, it must be different somehow, right? So what's going to be the different point that Elihu draws from it, that the Lord draws from it as opposed to Elihu? All right, let's take one more. Yeah, John? Yes.
And we've got to take that as real truth. And I guess there's dozens of cultures that we've all seen, I guess, from time to time. But in most cases, a friend, I would expect a friend to immediately, maybe a friend, family, good leaders, to start with something consoling.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think John, you're raising an awfully good. But you remember Job says in chapter 16, "Miserable comforters are you all." Yeah. He gives them F grades in terms of comforters. And you know, all I can say is though, I mean, I really do think if I had been there, first of all, I think it's to their credit that they are willing to sit with him for 7 days and just grieve with him. I mean, I think that's great. And I think that if I had heard Job say things like, it had been better for me never to be born, and I wish I could die right now, knowing my big mouth, I'm almost sure I would have felt like I just have to say something. And I think that's how it kind of went from there. Yeah, somebody else had a comment. Yeah, Darren? Yeah.
You know, because the friends are sitting there, they're trying to help him by telling them what they all think they know. And now God's going to come in and go, you all don't think you know, don't know what you think you know. None of them.
So Darren just made a great point. And you all have heard the old illustration, and I think it actually comes from India, from Indian folklore, about the blind men and the elephant trying to identify the elephant. Everybody heard it's an old famous story, where these blind men are all asked to go and identify an object. And one of them feels the side of the elephant and says, this is big and vast and strong, it's a wall. And the other one grabs the trunk and he says, you know, this is round and long, this is obviously a snake. And one of them grabs the tail and says, you know, it's, you know, fibrous and stiff, it's a rope. And one of them puts his arms around the trunk, the leg, and says, this is powerful and round, must be a tree trunk. And, of course, the moral of the story is because they're blind and they each only have a part of reality, none of them can put the whole picture together. And I think what Darren just said about the friends, like the Pharisees, sometimes not knowing what they don't know, given the information they all have accessible to them that they think is true, they're each offering their best picture of what's taken place. But, of course, all of them have an incomplete picture. And it's particularly incomplete because what does everybody in the book share? Belief in what? See, I thought subliminally here, Yes, that's right. So, you know, I always put it in a triangle. So I thought, yeah. So, yeah, they all share belief in the principle of retribution, and that's what's throwing things off. All right, well, with all of that, sorry, yeah, John, go ahead.
The main thing I'm thinking at this point is the various times I've studied or been in classes where we study Job, there's a lot of hypotheticals
right.
About various things, Israel or whatever. And I just want to say the study, in my estimation, has gone just right. Just the facts. I mean, the facts of what you're bringing up.
Well, I mean, I appreciate that. We're just trying to follow the text and just get what was the point of the storyteller. You know, what would he wanted us to get? So thank you for those kind words. All right, well, I'm very excited because we have come to the main event, which is the Lord's speeches. Although, like a lot of other aspects of the book of Job, how to understand the Lord's speeches here is a great mystery. What I'm going to say to you is that I think, broadly speaking, a traditional, I'm not going to say it's the tradition, but I would say a traditional interpretation of these speeches, there's two of them, chapter 38 and then chapter 40, goes something like this. Job, I am the creator, I am all powerful, and I'm all wise, and you're neither of those things, and you just ought to be quiet. I mean, I think that's a view of the book that basically I've had for a long time. And it's a view of the book that I think I've picked up, maybe in not so many words, from others. That's the whole point of these speeches here of the Lord. And I want to say to you that after studying the book over the last few years, I've come to the conclusion that that's not exactly how to best understand these speeches. Now, there's no question that Job has said a lot of wrong things. I've pointed them out to you as we've gone through this. There are a lot of things he said that are not true. And let me show you one of them in particular just to remind you what I'm talking about. Look over at Job's sort of last stand, which starts in chapter 29, and just remind yourself of what Job's estimate of his relationship with God is like. This is in chapter 29 where he starts to talk about the good old days. Verse 2, "Oh, that I were as in the months of old." And notice what he says he thinks was true of the good old days, but is no longer true in the rest of verse 2. "As in the days when God watched over me." Verse 4, "As I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me." Job says, "I wish it was like the good old days when God was still with me, still cared about me, still knew what was going on in my life." Now, we can totally understand why Job thinks that's no longer the case if we were in his shoes. But of course, it isn't the case. And we know it isn't the case because the entire basis on which the book is built is God's watching over Job, so much so that he calls Job to the attention of the accuser and says, "There's nobody like my guy. This is my guy. He's the best of them all." And as those opening chapters unfold, God very painstakingly protects Job from whatever the accuser may want to do. There's limits to it, in other words. And that's been the case all through the book. So I say to you that there is a sense in which there is a lot for which Job needs to say, "Wow, I was way off base in a lot of what I've been saying." But I don't think that the primary point of the Lord's speeches here at the end of the book is simply to exert his power and wisdom in an effort to tell Job, "You should pipe down." I think there's something more interesting going on here. What I think the Lord is going to get at to Job is this. Job, just because you don't recognize my presence in your life, that doesn't mean I'm absent. It's possible for me to be present and active, even when you don't think that's the case. And I'm going to illustrate for you, I think the Lord says, from a lot of different angles, how I'm active when nobody could even possibly know that I'm active. As a way to illustrate to you, you've jumped to a huge conclusion to assume that I'm no longer looking over you. And to me, this is the great practical value of the book, because I think a lot of us, at times, feel like Job. We have these times where we just think, where are you? Why have you let this happen? And does this mean you've abandoned me? And I think the Lord's speeches, which obviously are going to be far beyond our ability to totally comprehend, nevertheless get this point across. Okay? So let's just start off here, chapter 38, verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" So the first question I ask you tonight, and it's one of the big debates right out of the gate here, is who's the Lord talking to? So who just finished speaking? Yeah, Elihu just finished speaking. So is the Lord telling Elihu to pipe down and be quiet, or is he referring, skipping back to Job? Now, I guess in a way, if you think about it, I've already tipped my hand as to who I think he's talking about, because I've already said to you that I don't think anybody ever refers to Elihu again in the book after he's done talking. So if you picked up on that, then you would know that at least my own view is that he's referring to Job. And, you know, I told you all last week that I kind of went back through Elihu's speeches and tried to think of a way to put his speeches in the best light possible. All right, so here would be an argument in the favor of Elihu. Go back with me to chapter 35. And look at verse 16. What does Elihu say about Job in 35:16?
Opens his mouth emptily and he multiplies words without knowledge.
Yeah, Job, you multiply words without knowledge. Notice that the Lord says the very same thing here. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now, some people think that he's talking to Elihu and saying, you're doing the same thing you accused Job of. There's no way to answer this question definitively, though. I tend to think he's simply referring back to Job. And if he is referring back to Job, then all of you pro-Elihuites out there, like Dean, well, now you've got a mark in your favor, because you could say, well, hey, look, Elihu just said the same thing about Job that the Lord did here. So that'd be a mark in your favor there. Well, yeah, in verse 1 it says he's answering Job. But in verse 2, can you see how some people would say the first thing he says to Job is actually to ask a question like, who's this guy mouthing off over here, before he turns his attention? That would be the idea. I agree with you. It seems to me the most natural reading of the text is that he is answering Job. But trying to give Elihu the fairest shakes I can around here, you know. Yeah. Now, yeah, Darren's point is, you know, maybe he's kind of, you know, sort of a rhetorical. Like, you know, to all of everybody present, you know, Job, the friends, Elihu, Job's wife, the dog, whoever's there, you know, just like, you all don't know what you're talking about here. You know, I thought about that. Certainly. He's certainly aware of what's been said. Yeah, Andrew?
It almost seems like the Lord kind of answers all of Elihu's claims right out the gate, because the very last thing that he's been saying in chapter 37 is that God is this powerful storm, you know, and he literally says in verse 23, the Almighty, we cannot find him. He's this powerful storm beyond all of our comprehension in sight. And it's almost like a comedy film where it's like, a storm shows
right.
The Lord.
Right.
And so it almost seems like
yeah. Now, Andrew just brought up, sort of, this would be kind of maybe a sort of an anti-Elihu point, in that Elihu just got through saying, Job, you think God's ever going to show up to talk to you? Whoosh, the Lord shows up and says, hey, Job, I want to talk to you. So, yeah, I mean, that would be an anti-Elihu point there, I think, for sure. All right, well, let's not get bogged down here because we haven't even got to the really good stuff yet, right? So let's move on here. So verse 4, the Lord starts off by focusing on what we might call, in our own language, inanimate creation. The stuff that doesn't breathe and move, all right? So what are the different elements of the inanimate creation that the Lord starts talking about here? How does he start off? Yeah, the foundations of the earth, right? Look at verse 4. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? So the foundations of the earth. And the point you can see the Lord is making is, was Job there when that happened? Was any man there when it happened? Who was there when it happened? Yeah, God, and it mentions at the end of verse 7, the sons of God, the angels. All right, so the first point he's making is, when I laid the foundations of the earth, there was nobody present other than the angels to see it happen. All right, so Job, does the fact that you didn't see it happen mean I didn't do it? Of course, what's the obvious answer? No, God does it. Just because you haven't seen it doesn't mean that it isn't happening. Okay, what's next? What next does he mention? Yeah, the sea, verse 8. Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band? Prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far you shall come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. And you can see so many similarities between this language and the description of creation in Genesis 1, which talks a lot about God separating out and dividing stuff up, giving it form and structure. So he separates light from darkness. He separates the waters above from the waters below. He separates the water from the land, and he gives limits to everything out of the chaos and void. So that's essentially the same kind of point being made here. Verse 12, have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment. From the wicked, their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. So the Lord talks about light and darkness. Verse 16, the springs of the water. Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? This is the language, remember, in the flood story. Remember, how does it describe how the flood was generated? What two things open up? The windows of heaven and the fountains or floodgates of the deep. Yeah, so this is kind of the language here of creation. Verse 18, have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this. What does he bring up in verses 19 through 21? The dwelling of light. What about verse 22? Storehouses of snow. Verses 25 through 27, the rain. Verses 28 through 30, the rain, ice, and waters. Verses 31 through 33, what does he bring up there? Yeah, the stars, that's right. And verses 34 through 38, the clouds. All right, so the point of all of this is, here are things that God made, and it really is a reflection on Genesis 1. At one point, do human beings show up? Yeah, so you've got the previous 5 days, there's no person around even to see it. Does that mean it didn't happen? No, because God can be at work even when we don't see him at work. And remember, this all goes back to Job's complaint, which is he doesn't see God at work in his life. We know from the opening chapters, God is very much at work, even through this whole process. So the Lord's questions here, yeah, is he talking about the awesomeness of divine power? Of course. Is he talking about the grandeur of divine wisdom? Absolutely. But there's more to that, because he keeps saying to Job, you weren't around to see any of this, but it happened. All right, this point becomes even more clear when in the next part of this first speech, the Lord turns to what we might call the animate creation, things that can move and breathe. What are the various animals that he mentions in these verses? The lion, the raven, say that again, mountain goats, the wild donkey or deer. Some of these are going to be a little bit translation different because some of these Hebrew terms aren't well known. So donkey or deer, wild ox, what's next? The ostrich, horse, and then what are the last two? Yeah, the hawk and eagle. All right. Now, I ask you all, what do these animals have in common? Say that again. Yes, they are not domesticated. None of them are domesticated. The closest to domesticated would be the horse. And yet, the whole point, if you look at the description of the horse, is the horse is so powerful and scary, who wants to get really close to it? Now, what does that mean to say that they're not domesticated? What would it mean if they were domesticated? What would be true if they were domesticated? That's exactly right. A person would be taking care of them. Like, if you go back and look in the opening of the book, Job had a bunch of camels and donkeys and so forth. He's breeding them and taking care of them. He would feed them, shelter them, etc. The fact that they are wild animals means there is no person responsible to take care of them. All right, now then, given what we just said about the first part of this speech, what do you think the Lord is driving at by bringing up these particular animals? Who is taking care of them? Yeah, exactly. He is the one who in all of these different ways is providing. Job, you don't go out here and feed the lions. Do you think that means they're not fed? Job, you can't climb up into the high rocks where the mountain goats are. But you think that means because you can't get up there and feed them, nobody's feeding them? You can't fly up to the high crags where the raven and the eagle are. But guess what? They're being fed. Even the ostrich, which is in the ancient world considered one of the dumbest animals. It doesn't make it. It's so heavy it has to lay its eggs on the ground. It can't fly up into a tree. And what kind of bird would lay eggs on the ground where anybody could just come along and trample them? And yet ostriches keep having ostriches. So who do you think's taking care of all of these wild, undomesticated animals, Joe? Even though no man is taking care of them. See how it's the same point that the Lord was making about the inanimate creation, which is, look, just because nobody was there to see when I did all these things doesn't mean they're not being done. And just because you don't see me out here taking care of these animals, that doesn't mean that they're not being taken care of. All right, now then, let's tack on to that another observation. There's a reason why the Lord brings up these particular animals. First of all, to make the very point you guys just made about the fact that they're wild, they're not domesticated, yet God is taking care of them. But there's another reason I think that the Lord brings at least three of them up. And that's because we've already seen these animals previously in the book. In fact, when we saw them, I told you, if you put notes in your Bible, this would be a good time to draw circles, stars, arrows, something to indicate we're going to come back to this here. So I ask you all to take a concordance and look these animals up. So first of all, the donkey. Where have we seen the donkey previously in the book? Whoops. You didn't see that. Yeah, so let's go back. Thank you, Paul. Man, this guy here, he is so on top of his game. All right, your mom's not even here to show off in front of tonight. All right, so go over to chapter 6. Yeah, all right. Chapter 6. We're going to get a couple of them here. Job says, chapter 6 and verse 5, does the wild donkey bray when he has grass? And what's the answer? No, he brays when he doesn't have it, when he has a need, and he's complaining. And the ox low over his fodder. No, the ox groans when he doesn't have any. Now, in the context here, Job is saying, if you hear me complaining, why, any animal would complain if it's not being taken care of. So Job is comparing himself to animals unfed. In this case, the ox and the donkey. All right, go on over to chapter 24. This was one of the passages that we talked about where Job, for the first time, one of the first times, I should say, starts to question the law of sowing and reaping, the principle of retribution, when he talks about, in this chapter, the injustices he has seen. In chapter 24, he says in verse 2, some move landmarks, they seize flocks and pasture them. They drive away the donkey of the fatherless. They take the widow's ox for a pledge. They thrust the poor off the road. The poor of the earth all hide themselves. Now look at verse 5. Behold, like wild donkeys in the desert, the poor go out to their toil, seeking gain. Who does Job compare to wild donkeys in the desert? The poor. And why does he make that comparison? Is anybody in Job's mind taking care of them? No. And they have to fend for themselves. That's exactly right. And in the context, what he's talking about is the injustice of the wicked oppressing the poor, and it seems like nobody's there. And notice that the animal he uses to describe this is the donkey. We can make the same point about the oxen here, right? So if you go on down and look at go back up to verse 3, he mentions the ox who is taken as a pledge. And it's the same animal he used to describe himself. And then look over in chapter 30. Chapter 30. When Job in verse 29 wants to describe his isolated condition, what two animals does he compare himself to there? In chapter 30 and verse 29. The jackal and the ostrich. And I think this was the one where we found some translations maybe render it owl. I'm not sure if yours does or not. But anyway, and I made a big point about this verse. In fact, I even said to you, now why would I spend so much time on one verse? Because jackals and ostriches are what kind of animals in the Bible? Yeah, they're scavengers. And in fact, what I pointed out to you is where you see them mentioned a lot are in Old Testament prophets who are talking about God's destruction upon a city when the Lord is going to put such a whammo on the city that nobody's left except these creatures right here. So they are creatures used to identify basically a God-forsaken, desolate, judged, destroyed city, and that's exactly how Job describes himself here in chapter 30 and verse 29. And so now you see that the Lord just happens to pick out these very animals that throughout the book, wild ox, wild donkey, and ostrich, that were used as symbols of a lack of God's attention and care to make what point? Job, I'm taking care of these animals. You may not see it, but I'm doing it. Now then, what point do you think Job was supposed to draw from that? Exactly right. If I think I'm like these animals, and God just told me, hey, Job, just because you don't recognize it, I'm taking care of them, then maybe, just maybe, the Lord's taking care of him. It just so happens that is precisely the case, isn't it? And we know so from the opening chapters of the book. Job didn't know that based on what he observed. He drew, I think, the conclusion that given his set of beliefs and his circumstances was the only conclusion for him to draw. He just didn't realize his set of beliefs were incomplete. And he didn't realize there were more to his circumstances than one what meets the eye. Does that make sense to you guys why these particular animals are being brought up here? All right, so then I ask you all some follow-up questions in connection with this part of the Lord's speech. Really, I just asked this question. Just as God was at work in the inanimate world, even though this was inaccessible to mankind, God is also at work in the animate world, caring for various wild animals, normally inaccessible to man. What point do you think God is making? And that is that God is at work in his life, even if he can't see it. Can you think of any other stories of the Bible that would be good illustrations of this same point? Yeah, I mean, I think probably if we took a poll and pondered it, that'd be the one that comes up, right? A lot. And we'll talk about it on Sunday. The story of Joseph, when he's thrown into the cistern and he hears his brothers plotting to murder him, and then they sell him off as a slave, and then he languishes from one form of bondage to the other. I mean, at that time, I'm sure Joseph didn't realize, you know, what was going on, other than, you know, he does seem to kind of escape harm in each circumstance. But it's really only when he interprets the dreams of Pharaoh that you kind of get the sense that everything kind of clicked into place, you know, for him. But yeah, I think that would be one of the prime examples of this same point, of God being at work, even though in the present circumstances we may have a very difficult time seeing this. Any other stories come to your mind like that?
Jesus' point about not worrying. He talks about the lilies in the field, the birds in the sky, how God takes care of them.
Yes, matter of fact, that's just a beautiful segue to the next point here. Let's compare this to Jesus' Sermon on the Mount here. So let's turn over to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. Verse 25, Matthew 6, 25. Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. I almost imagine Jesus here on the mount and a flock of, you know, seagulls flies by. You know, he says, hey, look at these birds. And he says, are you not of more value than they? And which of you by being anxious can add a single hour to his span of life? And why are you anxious about clothing? Consider, just imagine a point of the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is alive and tomorrow thrown into the oven, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Yeah, I think it's precisely the same point. It's the very same concept Jesus is getting across here that the Lord is getting across in this first speech. If you think about creation, yes, my power is unparalleled. Yes, my knowledge is unlimited. But there's more than that. It's my presence and involvement, even in times when it doesn't seem obvious that that's the case. But it is, in fact, the case. And that's what he wants Job to understand, I believe, in this first speech. Okay, any questions or comments so far? All right, well, we better hurry then and look at Job's response, right? So go over to chapter 40. The opening verses. So 40 verse 1, the Lord said to Job, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it. And remember, what has Job said chapter after chapter he wants? Yeah, I want to present my case to God. Right. And so now the Lord says, all right, you got a case now? Let me hear what it is. Because remember, Job's entire case was predicated on what belief? God doesn't care about me. He's abandoned me. And what has Job just seen explained to him? No, that's not true. That's not true. And so how does Job respond? Verse 3. Then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I've spoken once, and I will not answer. Twice, but I will proceed no further. So to go back to the language of a lawsuit, what has Job just said he's going to do? Yeah, he's withdrawing his case, right? I rest. And I'm not going to say it anymore. Yeah. Now, it's kind of teasing to think about this language here. I mean, I think all of us, when we read it, we go, yeah, because I've been there. I know exactly what it's like to open my big mouth and then realize I made a mistake and now realize I just need to zip up. So I don't want to take away from the poignant message God has just given to him and how it applies to all of us. To be reminded that, yeah, in the midst of terrible suffering, and let's not forget what Job has lost in this book. In the midst of terrible suffering, it is a natural reaction to wonder where God is. You see this language all through the book of Psalms. You hear Jesus say it when he's on the cross, and he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? It is an absolute natural reaction. But what Jesus called the disciples to ponder in the Sermon on the Mount and what the Lord is calling Job to ponder now is, don't let your immediate circumstances blind you to the bigger picture of my presence. God has never, ever promised that he would always just swoop in and pick us all up from any problem we ever had. He's just never promised that. Every now and then he does that. Right? I mean, every now and then there's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego saved from the furnace. Or a Daniel saved from the lion's den. So there's no question that he does that. But sometimes, often, God sustains us through our circumstances. Like Joseph's 17 or so years in enslavement and imprisonment. 13 years, rather. From age 17 to age 30, 13 years, all of his 20s. But God sustained him through that. And so it's a mistake for us to think that the only way God can be at work is he just airlifts us out of the problem. No, it's more subtle than that. And sometimes what God does is he protects us and sustains us through our problem. And Job didn't realize it, but that's what's been happening to him. This whole time, he's been actually shielded and protected from worse that could have happened to him. And I think that that's the point of this first speech. Yeah?
The Israelites are one of the biggest examples, you know. He freed them from Egyptian rule, and then they all had to complain, but he still sustained them through
great. What a great illustration, Darren. Yeah, the Lord's sustaining Israel through its wilderness wandering and, you know, many other such episodes. Very good. All right, now, that's the first speech, and it would have been sufficient, right? Like we were talking about, you know, Dwayne said, you know, the book could have ended at chapter 3, all right? Well, you know, it could kind of end right here, right? Chapter 40, verse 5, the end. Job says, you're right, I was wrong, I drop it. But the Lord's not done. The Lord has another point to make. Now, is he just, you know, rubbing Job's nose in it at this point? Like, hey, you're really wrong, Job. I'm really going to show you how wrong you are. No, I think that there's actually quite a profound point that the Lord is going to make in his second speech, which starts in chapter 40 and verse 6. But we'll get there, good Lord willing, next week. Now, some of our college kids, you have finals next week. How many of you have to leave before next Wednesday's Bible class? Because I'll just tell you, I would change plans. In fact, I'd skip going home for Christmas just to finish the book of Job here in this class, all right? But no, well, great. I'm glad that it looks like all of you will be here for next week.